Chami, thank you very much. And can I add my welcome to Chami? It's great to see you this Wednesday lunchtime. I'll speak for about just under 20 minutes, and then we'll have a chance, I think, today for Q&A or chatting around the tables. And then we promise to be done by 1:45 so you can get back to work. Well, have a look, please, with me at John's Gospel on page 6, chapter 2. And look with me, please, at verse 11. John writes, "This was the first of Jesus' signs that Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and he manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." When I talk of the glory of God, I wonder what images come into your mind. Perhaps you think of a marvellous fresco, maybe the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel or something like that. Or maybe you think of some wonderful choral music. Or perhaps you think of standing on a mountaintop and looking out over creation. And all these things, they draw us out of ourselves, don't they, to a sense of wonder, to a sense that there is something beyond us. Maybe when you hear the phrase the glory of God, you think of God's wisdom in the Bible. Maybe you think of Jesus' resurrection from the dead. I guess all of us are long to see God's glory in the midst of what might be a fairly mundane working day. We long to be drawn out of ourselves to see something of the wonder of the Lord. And what John tells us is that here, as Jesus turns water into wine, he shows his glory. And it's the glory that leads his disciples to put their faith in him. But I guess the question becomes, well, how? How is this thing with the wine really showing God's glory? Is that really the glory of God? And I want to suggest that we see God's glory from three angles in this passage. You'll see I've jotted them down on the handouts on the table if you find that kind of thing helpful. And the first way we see God's glory in this sign is that Jesus' glory is a powerful glory. I guess for some of us, this will be a fairly familiar story. So let's try and imagine ourselves afresh into the scene. It is a wedding, and Jesus is invited. It may well be one of his relatives, because his mother Mary seems to be pretty involved in the catering. And it is a great celebration. Jesus goes along with his disciples. The flowers are beautiful. The food is wonderful. The bride and the groom, they've scrubbed up okay, and everyone thinks they're kind of a good match. The bride's friends are delighted. The groom's friends are frankly relieved. And it's a big event. It's in full swing. Back in the day, it would have lasted for several days. And then they hit a problem, verse 3. When they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They've no wine." Now, that is not just a party buster, because in a culture of honor and shame, that was a massive humiliation. And in fact, it would have given the parents of the bride the basis for a lawsuit against the groom, this humiliation of running out of wine. Well, Mary turns to Jesus. We're not quite sure what she expected him to do. John says this is Jesus' first miracle, so she's probably not expecting a miracle. She's probably just turning to her oldest son in a moment of panic. And Jesus' reply is slightly cold in verse 4. Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." Well, Mary's not put off. Verse 5, she says to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." And so Jesus takes charge. So verse 6, there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. So in your mind, don't picture a kind of Lakeland earthenware mini jug. You know, these are huge, big things, right? 125 litres is kind of, roughly speaking, slightly bigger than me. And there are 6 of them lined up. Well, verse 7, Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they fill them up to the brim. And he said, "Now draw out some and take it to the master at the feast." So they took it. Do you know, I would love to know what the servants were thinking as they took what they thought was water to the master of the feast. The master said, "He's going to kill us. We've run out of wine and he's going to find out when we give him this water." Well, they give it to the master of the feast. And with a sigh of disdain, he looks at it. What's this terrible plonk they're serving up towards the end of the party? And with a sigh, he begins to sip it. And wow, it's an ecstatic confluence of malolactic aromas. There's a bit of raspberry, a bit of artichoke, a bit of soggy mongrel. It's amazing. He loves it. So verse 9, when the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine and didn't know where it had come from, though the servants who drew the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people are drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This is the first of his signs that Jesus did in Galilee, and he manifested his glory. So how is it that this sign shows Jesus' glory. Well, at the most basic level, it's a powerful sign. It's a powerful glory. He turns water into wine. So I've got a bottle of water over here. I can't do it. I can't take this and turn it into Chateau Lafite just like that. When I was in sixth form, I had a friend who got into brewing his own beer. I mean, it was a nightmare. He had loads of chemicals, tubes, barrels. It took him weeks and it tasted terrible. You know, you go on a wine tasting tour on your summer holidays. You walk around the vineyard. They tell you how much time and effort they put into making the wine. Well, here Jesus just does it in an instant. It is a powerful glory. But why this particular miracle to show his glory? I mean, why not do some weightlifting? That'd be powerful. Or maybe he could disappear. I can't do that. Why water into wine? We remember a couple of weeks ago, we looked at John chapter 1 and we saw the way that John introduces Jesus. He says of Jesus, John chapter 1 verse 3, all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So he said right at the start of the gospel that Jesus is the agent of creation, the one through whom everything has come into being. And now Jesus' first miracle is a miracle of creation. So as we see Jesus create wine out of water, we realize that actually everything that John has said about Jesus up till now is true. He really is the one through whom everything came into being. This is a powerful glory because it's pointing us not just to the wine, but to all that Jesus creates. And so we're left wondering at his power, his ability, his creativity. I guess the wine types have their awards, don't they, for best vintner in whatever region it is. We love to celebrate anyone who makes something good. Well, Jesus is the one through whom our wonderful world was created. The wine that we enjoy, the food that we eat, the cold air that we suck into our lungs on a run, the laughter with friends over a glass of wine. It's all from him. It is a powerful glory. But secondly, it is an abundant glory because it's not just a little amount of wine here. It's a huge amount. Think of it, six large stone jars. I mean, I could use one of them as a personal plunge pool to dive into the wine. And there's all six of them filled to the brim. It's an abundance of wine. And it's quality. It's really good. So here's something I find slightly surprising about this passage, is John's emphasis. So we might think to ourselves, at what point does John tell us that Jesus actually turned water into wine? And it's in verse 9. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where to come, he tells us in passing. This is a subordinate clause. The water which, by the way, had now become wine. It's kind of an understatement of the year, isn't it? What he really impresses on us is the quality of the wine. He seems much more interested in the reaction of the master of the feast than the fact that the water's been turned into wine. So what we're seeing here is an abundance in the quantity of wine and an abundance in the quality. It's really good. It's an abundant glory. So again, why this miracle? Why not turn stones into canapes? Or ice sculptures are trendy, aren't they? Why not turn a thorn bush into an ice sculpture? Well, I think it's the significance of the wine. So let me read to you from Isaiah chapter 25. And this is Isaiah looking forward to a day when God himself will come and lead his people out of slavery into freedom, into heaven, really, into his new kingdom. Here's what Isaiah writes. Isaiah 25, verse 6. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine. Rich food, full of marrow, of aged wine, well refined. He will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He'll swallow up death forever. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. So here's Isaiah, picturing God's great kingdom to come, picturing heaven. And the language he uses is that of a feast. Of aged wine, abundant wine, the place of no tears. And now Jesus comes, and the first miracle he does is to turn water into an abundance of wine in the middle of a feast. What he's showing us that he is the Messiah. He is the one who is going to lead us into that kingdom. We're not there yet. We're not in heaven yet. But he started leading us there. His glory is glorious because he's the one who brings us there. I wonder what your image of heaven is. Maybe just sitting floating around on a cloud, a bit dull. Maybe you think of heaven as being kind of like a luxury hotel. It's all very nice, but you wouldn't really want to live there. Well, the image that Isaiah gives us of heaven is of a wonderful banquet. You know, the table's laid out with fine tablecloths. You know, like there's so much cutlery in front of you. You know you've got to work from the outside in, but there's cutlery there. You don't even know what it does. Wine poured out, and not a kind of stiff formal banquet, but a joyous banquet, not on your best behavior. A great celebration. And that is what Jesus signals he's come to bring as he turns this water into this abundance of wine. He's the Messiah come to lead us into that kingdom that is good. It is an abundant glory. So you may remember the campaign that the atheists had on the buses a few years ago in London where they paid for all those adverts to go out. And the adverts said, "There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." Very clever campaign, because it gets to that sneaking suspicion that we have that actually God is a killjoy. That if I'm following God, I need to be worried and I'm not going to enjoy life. It's the complete opposite of what we see here. As Jesus comes and he begins his ministry by pouring forth this good wine into a feast. If we poured into that atheist propaganda, then it's maybe worth asking where it is that we're looking for abundance. At a wine bar on a work night out? A bigger box a little bit further up the org chart at work? The praise of people? But you know, God's heavenly banquet will make the feast of this world look like a Boots meal deal in comparison. It's interesting, Isaiah uses pictures of worldly pleasures to point us forward to that far greater kingdom to come. It may be that we kind of see through the atheist propaganda, but we still just have that sneaking suspicion. But is it really the best life to follow Jesus? What if I could not be a Christian today? What would I do? I'd be pretty miserable, actually. I'd have no hope. Why is a good God allowed this to happen? Well, it's my ultimate hope is that kingdom to come where there'll be no more tears and no more death. The promise of heaven is not just getting through judgment by the skin of my teeth. It's being brought into an abundant kingdom. And I guess the thing about abundance is that we lack nothing. I guess if I was to say to us, what do you feel like you're lacking at the moment? We'd all be pretty quick with our answers. But not in heaven. Here is an abundance. This is God's good character. So we see with Jesus here a powerful glory and an abundant glory. And I guess the question we're left with is, how do we enter this kingdom to come? And thirdly, we see here an ultimate glory. So look back with me, please, at verse 4. Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." It's a slightly strange phrase, isn't it? A strange response. But that phrase of the hour is a reference that will come throughout John's Gospel, if you take away and read it. Jesus keeps on saying his hour has not yet come until we get to chapter 13 and he's about to go to the cross. And that is the hour. That is the moment of Jesus' supreme glory. That is where Jesus opens up the kingdom for us to enter. The Bible is pretty clear that none of us are good enough to enter God's feast in our own strength. We're all sinful. We've all done things that are wrong. And that sin, it clings to us like mud clinging to us on a February afternoon walk in the countryside. But when Jesus died on the cross, if we put our confidence in him, he's paid the penalty for our sin that we might be washed clean. So the hour has not yet come, but as Jesus takes the initiative from his mother for himself, he gives us a hint, a foretaste of that ultimate glory to come, when he'll die on the cross and wash us clean of all of our sins. Do you remember the purpose of those water jars that Jesus used? they were for purification. So people would come in from the hot, dusty street and they'd wash their hands, and it was sort of symbolic of washing away their sin before sitting down for a meal. But all it did was wash the dust off their hands. Even if they did plunge into the whole thing, it wouldn't wash them inside. But the cross is the moment where Jesus cleans us completely from all that is wrong and enables us to come into that ultimate abundant banquet. Everything about the new age that he's bringing forward is better. The feast is better. The cleansing is better. This is an ultimate glory. Now we'll think more about that next week when we see Jesus in the temple. But now we need to see that I cannot cleanse myself, get myself scrubbed up and ready for the banquet. I need Jesus to do that. It's in Jesus that there is total forgiveness, total grace, not just a pardoning, but an abundance of blessing. I guess if this afternoon I was heading off to Buckingham Palace for a feast, I'd feel awkward and a little bit out of place. But actually in Jesus we're washed clean, that we can enter that feast and belong. How extraordinary that we can belong in the presence of God at his eternal banquet. In the glory of Jesus is that he has done what I cannot do. So, a powerful glory, an abundant glory, and an ultimate glory. And I guess the question we're left with, that John keeps putting to us, is how do we respond? So verse 11, this was the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Mary took that rebuke from Jesus, but she kept her confidence in him. The disciples saw the sign and they believed. No mention of the servants here. They seem to have seen the sign and not believed. It seems to have passed them by with a shrug. And the question John wants to put to us is, will we believe in Jesus, his power, his abundance, and his cleansing of us of our sin?